Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne on 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month and rebroadcast on the third Monday. And if you enjoy podcasts, you can listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select the podcast tab. This edition of Medical Musings is pre-recorded and will cover two separate topics. January is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month and National Blood Donor Month. First, I will be speaking with Mary Fiedler about cervical cancer, and after the break, Betsy Robinson of the American Red Cross of the Inland Northwest will be joining me. The goal of this month is to both educate the public about cervical cancer and therefore to decrease the incidence. Cervical cancer is a totally preventable disease, and we'll talk more about that with Mary, as long as the woman has ongoing screening and the HPV vaccine. Even though we have good screening guidelines, there are still about 200,000 positive tests for HPV yearly, of which 80% of the population, both male and female, does contact the virus at some time in their lives. However, many cases clear on their own. About 10% or about 22% of the positive HPV tests lead to a cancer diagnosis. That's 13,000 plus in women, or cervical cancer, and 4,300 or 4,400 deaths each year. I'd like to introduce Susie Perez from our morning show, and she is vital to helping me produce this show.
Thank you, Dr. Joanne. I'm very delighted to be helping out, and thank you for bringing medical musing to the KRFY airwaves and listeners. I wanted to let the listeners know a little bit about you. Dr. Joanne has been a longtime volunteer at KRFY, broadcasting previously during Otto's Eclectic Mix, and now hosting the show Medical Musing with Dr. Joanne, airing the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Also, as you said, you can listen on as a podcast at krfy.org. So who is Dr. Joanne? Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010, previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years, and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics as needed once they moved to Sandpoint. As the media spokesperson for Central Ohio Pediatric Society, you contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. You also have four children. So that's who Dr. Joanne is.
So I did have a lot of experience with children. As I noted in my introduction, Mary Fiedler, nurse practitioner, is here in the studio with me. Mary, please introduce yourself to our listening audience.
Hi, I am retired now. I still have a license that's active for a few more years, but my subspecialty in nurse practitioner is a women's health nurse practitioner, and my background primarily is in public health. And so I love the topic of cervical health and ways to prevent before it even gets to cancer, because it is 100% preventable. HPV, like you said in your introduction, is almost most people are exposed to it in their life, but most people do clear themselves. So it's not preventing it, but preventing the effects of the changing the cells on the cervix that we can do and help people about. So
I know your goal and that of the American Cancer Society and many clinicians is to eliminate cervical cancer.
Yep.
And actually all cancers caused by HPV, the human papillomavirus. So how are we going to reach that goal? What do we need to know about cervical cancer testing and follow-up?
So,
and you can do each topic separately.
Okay. So the testing, the Pap smear, which is short for Papanicolaou smear, which is brushing some cells off the surface of the cervix to make sure that they're normal size and shape, along with HPV testing. And really, when we say HPV testing, we're talking about high-risk HPV. HPV is also responsible for causing genital warts, but that's not a carcinogenic strain, type 6 and 11, but it's the other types that we're more concerned because of the can change the cells and turn into cancer. So what the Pap smear does and HPV testing is, if you're HPV positive, but the cells on your cervix haven't changed. We don't care so much. We're just going to monitor and make sure that the cells don't start changing. So if we start, and then, so then you would be in more frequent follow-up for the screening. And then if the cells on your cervix start changing, we can do conservative management and just watch low-grade changes. We know we don't need to do anything about. But if they progress to more moderate or high-grade changes, that's when we can remove those cells so that it doesn't progress to cancer.
So that's why HPV testing has been added to the Pap smear. So women get the Pap and separate HPV testing.
Correct.
Again, and then if HPV is positive, as you said, there are strains that aren't quite as serious or as serious. They preventing mouth or cervical, or I'm sorry, mouth or anal or cancer, are especially are those that can be found. But you're not culturing the anus, obviously.
No, we typically, no.
You don't usually do that.
We just do the HPV testing in women in the vagina, or cervical.
So what is the follow-up? Let's go over that a little bit.
Well, as I mentioned, if it's just low-grade changes, we're just going to do surveillance, increased surveillance, like have them come back in 1 year versus 3 to 5 years. And if it starts showing that it clears on its own, great. If it doesn't clear on its own and it's progressing, then we would triage them to a procedure called colposcopy, which is basically just looking at their cervix through a scope that magnifies the cells on the cervix, because you can't see cervical cancer. You can't see the cellular changes. But through the colposcope, you can see the changes, and then you would take a little sample of tissue, which is called a biopsy, and that would be the confirmatory test. So Pap smear is a screening test. The biopsy would be the confirmation.
The definitive test. So really it's to encourage women to see a women's health provider and get started in this system. Susie, did you have something you'd like to say?
So what I'm hearing you say, and kind of what you're leading up to, Joanne, Dr. Joanne, is there isn't necessarily symptoms early. It's called regular care and testing as you're young and growing up, instead of maybe symptoms that
exactly
would send
it
you to the
is
doctor.
Asymptomatic. And another good thing about cervical, well, not that it's a good thing about cervical cancer, but it's very slow growing, and that's why we know we don't need to do cervical cancer screening every year, which is what was recommended for us three here, but that it's at intervals, and we don't recommend Pap smears at age of sexual debut anymore, which is what we used to when they're first exposed, because virtually everyone will be exposed. So we don't care that you're exposed. We care if it causes changes to the cells on your cervix. And so that's why women should get their first Pap smear at age 21.
Is there a time and place as a woman grows older and matures where Pap tests are not necessarily recommended because...
Good question. Yes. Age 65. One needs to have, well, there's several. Age 65, you can stop routine screening unless you've had high grade screenings in the previous 20 years, then you go beyond 65. You also can stop Pap smear screenings after hysterectomy for a non-cancerous, non-cervical cancer reason. So a lot of times people get hysterectomies just for uterine fibroids, which are just benign growths. And if your cervix is removed with the hysterectomy, you no longer need cervical cancer screening. So,
So after 65, if you've had clear Pap results, then you're basically free to go.
Correct.
Okay.
Since age 45 or about that. So it would be 20 years never having a positive Pap or having an HPV positive.
Well, so you can have low-grade changes, but if you've had high-grade changes in the previous 20 years, then you should continue to be screened until you have good screenings for 20 years from whatever that age. So if you had it at age 55, you'd probably be screened through 75.
Okay.
And it's because it's slow growing, that's another aspect to that timeline.
Correct.
Okay.
Tell us if there are factors that we can avoid or at least decrease the chance of developing cervical cancer.
So one of the things that we alluded to, that virtually all cervical cancer is HPV related, and HPV is sexually transmitted. So limiting the total number of sexual partners. Condom use helps, but it's certainly not 100% because it's skin-to-skin contact. Not being a smoker, it's very interesting. Smoking does not cause cervical cancer, but it causes the HPV virus to replicate like 3 to 5 times as much. So whenever I would say that to a client, it was a big aha for them. I mean, everyone knows smoking's bad for you. Any healthcare provider is going to tell you to stop smoking. But when you make it very personal, like this is something you can do. You have HPV, there's nothing you can do about that, but you can prevent being exposed to more types of high-risk HPV. And not being a smoker to help clear yourself of the virus and help your cervical health. The HPV vaccine. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's the primary thing.
And we'll be talking about that in just a few minutes.
Perfect.
It's also related to the number of sexual partners, which some people, you know, again, are kind of aghast because you are asking that question. And maybe it's more because I was in pediatrics when some parents were really good. I want my child to be on birth control so that they don't have a problem. You know, I'm worried that they are. And again, you can't follow anyone around all the time. So that is a question. And I remember the smoking question, too. It was more of parents. And a child would come in with recurrent ear infections, and I'd look at their purse, and they had a pack of cigarettes. And I'd say something. And if they weren't my regular patient, they normally saw another of our group for most of their visits, they would be very aghast, and they would sometimes not come back purposely to me because I bugged them about smoking.
But so, that actually is a standard of care.
Yes,
that providers
definitely.
In the U.S., we talk about healthcare maintenance, and smoking needs to be brought up. It should be. So anyways.
So, and it's interesting because too frequent testing might yield more anxiety, and some women don't want to come back for that awful pelvic exam. And it's really not awful. It's just, you know, several minutes out of your life and you'll be fine. But it's hard for some people, especially if they've been assaulted or things like that.
And actually, most people, after having their pelvic exam, most people will say that was not so bad. The anticipatory fear or anxiety about it was way worse. Yeah. And giving them feedback, oh, the tissue looks healthy and normal, and what normal is, and doing all that education really goes a long way.
It does help because they've got this thing in their mind about a metal thing, a speculum that's being put inside you. And some people really are freaked about that or have a lot of anxiety. So, again, we're talking about pap smears and HPV testing and then the HPV vaccine. I was excited because I'd read the articles from the summer on to December that the HPV self-test was available. And it's interesting, as we've talked, Mary and I both talked to different providers, and they kind of say, well, we're not doing it yet. If you live here or there, or you've been assaulted and you really don't want to come into the doctor, it does have its place. But at the moment, at least I talked to people in Ohio, and Mary got some statistics from here. And basically, we don't know that people are really using it yet. But if you don't have insurance, you can buy it from Amazon and other providers. You just have to search HPV self-test, and you'll find places that you can buy it. Then they have to follow up, and hopefully they will follow up with a women's health provider.
Yeah, so it's a great option for people who aren't going to be screened at all. So
we're talking about education and understanding that early detection. We're talking about the vaccine. And in schools, when girls are young and they have sex education, is this brought up? This picture of cervical health and how to take care of yourself?
So I don't know the state of affairs right now, how that is. The health department did go in and give some talks, and that was certainly brought up when the health department was involved, and the health department no longer is going into the school. So I don't know how much is being taught to girls.
Some parents may not want that, but maybe the parents need the education.
There you go.
No, and unfortunately, we are not, you know, school teachers. And I can imagine certain areas won't want that at all, but adding HPV, the human papillomavirus, that the majority of people do carry at some time in their life is important for the school child, or the especially a teenager, to know.
Correct.
So let's talk a little bit about, well, one thing that I, when I was thinking about doing this topic, it was interesting because I was in med tech in the late 60s and early 70s, and the pap smear was the thing. And then when I looked at it, Dr. Papanikolaou first did that in 1941, so that the pap smear was looking for abnormal cells. The only test we had for cervical cancer until, and the pap smear was the only test we had until 2014. So the fact that although the HPV is a cause of cervical cancer, people weren't really looking, providers, we didn't have that option unless we did the colposcopy, the more definitive test. HPV is one of those viruses that's very long lasting. It may carry for years without symptoms. And so if the goal is to decrease cancer deaths between 1950 and 1990, or the 90s, cervical cancer was decreased by 70%. But then we haven't made that much of a dent, but now the World Health Organization, the American Cancer Society, everyone is trying to get to that zero.
Yeah.
And actually in Australia, and they started doing the self-test earlier in 2017, and they have a goal to eliminate cervical cancer by 2035.
And the vaccine plays an important role in that.
Huge, almost the primary reason. And the recommendation is, well, routinely age 12 to start it, so hopefully before women are or girls are sexually active. But you can even start it as early as age 9 up to age 45. We don't go beyond age 45. The benefit of it is markedly reduced after that time. But the earlier you get it, the more protection you get against HPV. So that's, yeah.
That's one of the very good talking points that we would give to parents, because parents would be aghast that I wanted to give their child an HPV, a sexually transmitted illness, you know, the background or the cause of that. And they would go, oh, no, not in my child. It's like the key point is that you develop better immunity if you get it young,
yeah,
if you've had no exposure.
And you only need 2 injections if you start the series before age 15. If it's after that, 16 or later, then you need 3. And again, you want to vaccines prevent. So once you've already been exposed to a certain type, then obviously the vaccine is not going to help, except for helping to protect you against the other strains that you don't have. So yeah.
So the HPV vaccine, the original Gardasil had 4 types, and now the immunization has 9 types. So we're really focusing on those 2, 6, and 11 that are mild and usually don't cause cervical cancer. And then the other ones are the ones that cause cervical cancer. So a positive is very important to follow up. Are there symptoms that women should be aware of that make a clinician suspect cervical cancer?
So some of the signs of cervical cancer would be very late in the process. So hopefully we're catching it before they even have symptoms. But bleeding or spotting after sex or irregular bleeding, pelvic pain, changes in bowel or bladder can also be symptoms. But again, those come very, very late. And, you know, the whole point of Cervical Health Awareness Month is that we are doing things before it even gets to that point. But and those symptoms, all that I just described, can also be symptoms of STIs or sexually transmitted infections as well. And hopefully that's your body talking to you that something's wrong and you need to get it checked out.
So bleeding when it's not time for your period, and then a watery or bloody vaginal discharge that might be heavier or have an unpleasant smell. And then the pain during intercourse, which is called dyspareunia. That's one of those medical words that a lot of people can't spell. So there are 200 types of human papillomaviruses, which is really, really interesting. But we know that 6 or more, up to the 9 types at least, and probably more, but that's what's in the vaccine, can cause cervical cancer, vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, penile cancer, anal and mouth and throat disease. So it's interesting. Again, parents say, oh, well, not yet for my child. But basically, as we said, they develop better immunity if they do get it early. And again, the men get more mouth and throat cancer than women do, which is very interesting. I, you know, particularly hooked since I came from Ohio, that the Ohio State James Cancer Center started a pilot study in 2019 that they sent self-testing kits to 103 women. And the return kits, they actually got the 80 of 103 is an interesting factor, a number, because it is more than some surveys get. And of those, 26% were positive for HPV. So again, the self-test is coming. It may not be here yet, but it is one of those things that we can put in our little armamentarium to go on and have more screening.
And I just want to repeat, that's a great, interesting study, but that HPV is just one piece of this. If you're HPV positive, then we need to do more to see, is being HPV positive changing the cells on your cervix? Because we often find the cells that are dysplasia or dysplastic, which is just precancerous. But when you say that word, what the women hear is they hear cancer, and it's like, no, this is, we can take care of this well before it becomes cancer.
So they will hopefully get put in the system and then have better follow-up. We don't want to make women anxious, but we want them to be encouraged to follow up with their women's health provider.
I think the word that you said earlier is fixable. It's you can
treatable.
Take care of it. Treatable. Thank you.
Yep.
And so what is, I mean, I'm not sure where you were going, Dr. Joanne, but
that's fine.
If someone is positive and it's early, is there something besides a hysterectomy?
Oh, well, so if it's early, yeah. So if we just do the pap smear and it comes back, let's just say a low-grade dysplasia, which is precancerous cells, we don't even do anything at that point. We say come back. I mean, you do a colposcopy, and let's say it comes back as a low-grade change. Then you say come back in 1 year, because we know what we used to do when I was growing up is we used to slice and dice women's cervixes, and we now know doing nothing, just close monitoring in your own body will clear itself of the virus and heal those low-grade changes on its own. So less is more. So over-papping is not a good thing. We used to tell women to come back in 6 months. Well, of course it didn't change. It's not a long. It can take like 18 months for you to clear. So we're just doing closer surveillance, and hopefully the body is going to help heal itself and or clear itself. And if it doesn't, then we would remove the cells. So they used to freeze the cervix to remove the cells. That's not really utilized anymore. If it becomes a high-grade change, which is moderate dysplasia or severe dysplasia, or both of those are considered high-grade changes, or that you would do a procedure called a LEAP, which is just removing those abnormal cells.
Kind of clear it out.
Yeah.
Is there a point in time if someone did have those kind of cells showing up, not to worry, come back in a year, would that be a good time to get the vaccine? Or would it not affect what is currently happening?
It's not going to affect what's currently happening, but still the vaccine is recommended because the vaccine, maybe they only have one type of HPV, or maybe they only have two types, but the vaccine protects against 9 different types. 6 and 11, 2 of the types are not the kind that lead to cancer, so the other 7. So that's still benefit to prevent them from being getting future HPV exposure.
And
in
that's
their life.
Up to age 25, or, you know, they may increase the age. I'm not really sure, but
they go to 45.
Oh, now they go to 45.
Yeah,
okay, because it was 25.
Right.
Okay, so that's really important.
And it's
to
not
know,
as
too.
Effective the later you get
the
it.
The later you get it because you've had more exposure. You already have the antibodies, so the injection isn't going to rev up your immune system. You've already been revved, and some of the types you may have cleared on your own. So again, the HPV vaccine is so important, and back to the HPV self-test, because rural area, and there are women in rural areas who may not make the effort, but if they do the self-test and then they're positive, again, that's another, literally, a kick to get them into a provider. So at least calling their, we hope everyone has a primary care physician, but people don't really do that. So just a little bit on the self-test, because, again, I was so excited, and then I kind of thought and talked to some gynecologists, and they kind of were not using it yet. So I was interested in that. But if you lack insurance coverage, it can be purchased online. It may be expensive in your budget, but it can be as low as $69 and as high as $200+. So it does, especially if you have the fear, anxiety, you've been sexually abused, or and you just don't want that speculum exam, it's still really, really important. We talked about when to stop screening, 65 if low risk. Even if you've had the HPV vaccine, you still are in the 21 to 29 every 3 years, 30 to 65 every 5 years. Again, this is normal if you are normal. If or not normal, that sounds awful. But
the normal cells.
If you've had only normal cells on your testing, then you will be screened every 5 years if you're over 30 plus, so up to age 65. And just having the vaccine doesn't make you, you know, completely that you won't have any risk. You will have some, because no one knows how, well, not no one, because there were really good studies of how people developed antibodies after they had the vaccine. So there is some increased risk during menopause. I thought that was interesting. And I don't know if you've thought about that or used that kind of key that really the women age 50 plus to 65, or perhaps that's not.
Yeah, I don't
that was
know about
really
that.
Known
because actually, the HPV infects the part on the cervix, which is the squamous columnar junction, yeah, which is on the outside of the cervix when you're younger. But as you get older, it goes up into the inside into your endocervical canal. So there's natural protection there. So that's interesting that you found that, because I typically don't see that as a higher risk group. Okay. Or maybe it just means women that have not been screened as frequently then becomes a higher risk, because that's what I would like to see about that study, because the people that I have seen that I've diagnosed cervical cancer with have all not been
younger.
Not been regularly screened.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's the power in you that you can prevent this 100%.
And the HPV vaccine was introduced in between 2006 and 2007, and it does have an excellent safety profile. Teens faint, and that's pretty dramatic, and parents get really worried, but they faint with lots of shots or looking at the side of blood or some ugly, you know, basically the blood coming from an ugly cut or something like that. So fainting, as a medical provider, we don't worry about too much, but probably you should have your patients sit down.
Well, we definitely have them sit down, but if they have a history of fainting with injections, that's one of the questions we would ask at the health department. We just have them lay down on a table so that we just took that away from them and just gave the shot with them laying down, so to prevent the vasovagal response of the fainting.
And it's so very important to talk to your provider, keep your antenna up, literally, because a lot of people don't really realize how the HPV causes 100%, I guess, or maybe not 100, but of cervical cancer. There's even a bill before Congress brought up by a bipartisan bill. Yeah, it's called the Prevent Cancer and Saving Lives. And but the man who also joined with two women had a sister who died of cervical cancer. So basically, they're trying to get support in Congress for the HPV vaccine and the self-test. Okay, well, I think we've learned an awful lot about HPV. So our primary talking points, or the things that we want our audience to remember, are have a regular follow-up by a medical provider. If you do the self-test, again, find a medical provider who can follow you closely, and certainly to increase the uptake of the HPV vaccine for anyone age 9 and older. So both of those are really fundamental to eliminating and eradicating cervical and other HPV-associated cancers. A heartfelt thanks go to Mary Fiedler for joining me on Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Sharing your knowledge is so valuable for our listeners. You are listening to 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. Next up is our pre-recorded interview with Betsy Robertson, media specialist for the American Red Cross of the Inland Northwest. Welcome back to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. We now celebrate a second January designation, that of National Blood Donor Month. I'm speaking with Betsy Robertson of the American Red Cross of the Inland Northwest. That's the Spokane area and surrounding areas there in Washington and the five Idaho counties in the Panhandle. Betsy is the public affairs manager of our Inland Northwest chapter. I noticed in your signature, it also said Washington Flood. So we're just going to talk a little bit about that toward the end. So how does one become a public affairs manager? It sounds like a very interesting job and very worthwhile.
I love my job. I really do enjoy talking to people about the Red Cross, and I'm very proud of the organization I work for and get to speak on behalf of. Previously, my first 20 years of professional life was spent in the television world, broadcast television and news. And there came a time where I felt like it was, well, ready to try something new and flex some new muscles. And I had done some work with the American Red Cross in different capacities and found a position and an opportunity. And here we are.
I've been wonderful.
Red Cross for 9 years now.
Nice. So the history of National Blood Donor Month, it was interesting to read that it was established in 1969 by President Richard Nixon and first celebrated in January of 1970. Let's talk a bit more about National Blood Donor Month. What do you want to tell us about the importance of recognizing our donors and encouraging people to donate?
January is the start of, you know, so many new things, a new year, new habits, and a lot of folks are talking about resolutions. And we just want to throw in, if you're looking for a resolution that could make a meaningful impact, not just for yourself, but truly the community around you, resolve to become a blood donor this year. And that's a suggestion that we make. Great time to be thinking about it and to be aware of the benefits to our community and our overall community health by becoming a regular blood donor. Of course, the Red Cross is an option. Wherever you live, if there is an opportunity to give blood, find a way to make an appointment, and you'll just be doing a world of good.
Wonderful. So the Red Cross really celebrates, as I said, our donors, but again, encourages people and gives them, if we talk about it now, we're helping the awareness factor. So it's always education and awareness. Mm-hmm. But winter specifically is important.
Lots of reasons. Winter is a time when weather impacts our ability to collect blood. And we, as at the American Red Cross, we think about it from a national perspective. As an organization, we are the single largest contributor to the American blood supply. That's 40%. And that is the result of collections that take place coast to coast. And we rely on our regular, steady influx of donors that and donations that are made throughout the year. When weather hits and makes it difficult for us to collect blood in parts of our country, other areas need to pick up the slack. When our life schedules become, you know, busy, and they certainly do for lots of different reasons towards the end of the calendar year, between holidays and trips and family events, the the priority of donating blood tends to kind of fall off or down the list a bit. So it's a great time to reset, refresh, and recommit to becoming and being a regular blood donor.
That's a wonderful message, basically. And I love the fact that you tied it into New Year's resolutions. When we go to the gym, you see all these people in the class, like they're maybe overfull, and they have what, 15 or 20 people in the room. And by spring, by March, you have 8 or 10 people in the room. So there's a lot of making New Year's resolutions, and we hope definitely that you keep this one.
That's right.
Without immediate action, doctors have to make difficult decisions about which patients receive a transfusion and who will need to wait. I love the tagline that I found, and you have a little different one, but one is in thanking all of our blood donors, the 11,784,000 units donated per year, 1 hour of time gives someone else their tomorrow. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit then about how often people in the hospital need blood, or what statistic do we talk about when encouraging people?
The most important statistic is to recognize that the need for blood is constant. It does not take a vacation. It does not take a holiday. And whether it is people are receiving blood that you might not even think of, right? Cancer patients often receive transfusions as part of their treatment. People who have conditions like sickle cell are receiving blood transfusions as a part of their regular treatment. That is regular and ongoing. And then on top of that, you have the traumatic events, sadly, that are taking place every day in our country for a variety of reasons, traffic accidents, traumatic incidents. Mothers giving birth after the fact are often in a position to receive blood. So it's the need is there. It is always there. And so we just need to stay steady with the income of incoming donations that we can. And another important statistic is that only 3% of eligible Americans donate blood. We can do better than that.
It was really interesting because they said 38% or like over 30% is eligible, meaning you've got a good hemoglobin over 12 or 12.5 for men. You haven't traveled to Zika or Ebola areas,
Right.
and you don't have a chronic disease. So basically, that's again why we really want to get the word out. When 3% of 38%
Yeah.
donate, can be sort of a small number. It's interesting, this statistic that every site that I saw talks about the every 2 seconds someone in the US needs blood. And that's 42,000 units of packed red cells, platelets, and plasma daily. So again, that the other 25% of people needing it, the trauma, the surgery, the childbirth, are cancer patients. And they often need packed red blood cells or platelets and other chronic or for other chronic medical conditions. I know I had transfusions. I had a baby at 5 months who did not survive, 5 to 6 months actually, who did not survive. And after I had delivered that child who did not survive, or was not even resuscitated, I guess to say, about, oh, 4 to 5 days later, I started hemorrhaging in
Oh.
my closet.
Oh
And
my
I had to
goodness.
literally crawl to the phone and call the doctor, and they hadn't given me the medicine that makes your uterus contract. But then I was admitted to the hospital and received several transfusions. So, be interesting now to see what antibodies I have, basically.
Interesting. And isn't it important, and maybe you don't think about it at the time, but because blood was available when you went to the hospital, it was there. It was ready. It had, was prepared and treated and tested and ready to be transfused into someone who was in a dire situation. So I'm so sorry that happened to you, and so pleased that there was blood available on the shelves of the hospital when you needed it. And that's what we're trying to maintain.
Yeah, definitely. Although 1 in 4 of the donors are new donors, which was another really kind of interesting statistic. Let's get into blood types. And I know I'm going to try to give a understandable explanation for our audience, but what are the blood types that are in greatest demand?
So A, always O. A and B, we need all blood types, right? All blood types. But when you start getting into some of the specifics, type O blood donors are what is most often used in hospitals in those emergency situations, because of the ability to use them so universally. And so, I mean, we really want everybody to come in because the more diverse our blood supply is, the better we are able to serve, and patients are able to receive the blood type that is the closest match for them. So it's a dance between matching exactly in some cases for certain treatments and having that universal stock available, which are your type O's, when you're in a traumatic emergency situation.
And A negative and B negative are also important because they don't have the rhesus factor. And I'm going to explain to our listeners the two common primary classifications of blood types, the ABO system and the RH. We really encourage people to know your blood type, and that's another advantage. You're donating blood to really help all these people who are in hospitals or not yet in hospitals, who will be, or who have a chronic disease where your red blood cells are low, or even your clotting factors. When you donate blood, you receive a notification of your blood type. I have a little card, and it was plastic. I don't know. First, it was paper, and then I got a plastic card. So that was kind of like a credit card, and it had the information of my blood type. Your medical provider might know if you don't know, so that's another person to ask. I am A, and I have the A antigen. The ABO system refers to the antigens on your blood cells. And so I have A antigen, but I may have B or anti-B antibodies. So that's why if I got B blood, I may develop more antibodies, or that might have been the beginning of developing antibodies to my blood. If the antigen and the antibody react, then you're really breaking down your red cells, and you may not get any benefits or very few benefits from the transfusion, and you would feel not very good. My husband is B negative, and my daughter is B positive. He can only receive RH negative blood, whether it be B or O, which contains no antigens. And again, as you mentioned, O is the universal donor because the O people have no antigens. They don't have A. And they don't have B, and they don't have the RH factor. So again, it's very important to know. And again, it doesn't make you come in. Just the fact of the need is the most important thing to come in.
I have
AB
a
positive
negative.
is a universal recipient because that blood has all antigens. It has the A antigen, the B antigen, and the rhesus factor. So basically, all types are encouraged. You mentioned that the Red Cross is the biggest single collection agency, and it does 40%. I have a favorite memory, the Bloodmobile. It comes to different sites. Does the Bloodmobile still come to all sites, or are some of them permanent buildings?
We have a combination. The blood mobile has become sort of a van. It's more of a van that can go and set up shop at community centers, city halls, churches, schools. A lot of schools will host us for blood drives in a mobile capacity. And my region, which is Washington State and beyond, we did open two new fixed sites this year. One in Kennewick, Washington, and also one in Seattle. So that makes a total of three when you add Yakima in Washington State. And it's out of those facilities that we are able to dispatch our mobile teams
The
out
Bloodmobile.
into, yeah, the blood mobiles, the mobile groups that head out and gather blood. It's important that we are able to reach people where they are at. And make the process as convenient as possible.
Yeah, and so if you do 40%, then 60% are community blood centers by different companies. And I know that Bonner General uses a company other than the Red Cross. I wish they used the Red Cross because it's so ingrained in my mind that that's who collects, blood and safely, and you're not paying your donors. There's always been a kind of a, oh my goodness, if paid donors might be, drug addicts or this or homeless people, it's kind of scary because they then will be screened, so we won't have blood that has It's funny to say bad things, I guess, but
We do a lot of, there are a lot of safety protocols that go into the collection process, the screening, the testing, before it ever gets distributed, excuse me, to medical centers.
so basically, it's how do you know where a blood donation site is? It's interesting. I'm from Ohio, and the Ohio State Michigan game, they actually have a blood battle in the 2 weeks before the
Oh,
game.
that's
And
fun.
so there are signs everywhere on the Ohio State campus to donate blood. But again, your hospital, if there is a site, a permanent site, like you said, there are three in Eastern Washington, you just need to be alert. And that's why this program is so important, because it does give awareness that we need blood donors, and that maybe perhaps you'll be more alert to where blood can be donated. And then eligibility. Tell us a little bit about eligibility.
So the best thing to do as far as the Red Cross is concerned is to, visit our website, redcrossblood.org, and there is a whole section on eligibility because yes, there are certain, medical conditions that impact your eligibility to donate blood. There are certain risk factors with just behaviors that affect your eligibility, as well as medications that you may be taking. It is, there are a lot of details, and I should add that a lot of these questions are asked you when you do the screening, the pre-screening before you donate blood, so you can identify some of those things obviously ahead of time. I think what's most important to remember is that of those 38, that at 38%, only 3% are, right? Or 1 in 10 Americans are actively donating blood who can. So, and that's a number that we can do better than. So that means there are eligible folks out there who could be donating blood who haven't yet or have lapsed, right, in their regularity of doing so. I understand that, it may not be the there are a lot of folks in the world who are needle averse, right? Whether it's
Needle averse.
A flu shot or something else, right? Because that is part of the process. Is that's the process of collecting blood. What I can say is that we have, really trained wonderful phlebotomists at any blood collection center you go to who are trained in making it as comfortable and easy for you as possible. So let's make sure that we are creating awareness in our communities about the process being safe and easy, and just try to get people in. And once I think we've had you've donated once, hopefully we hook you for the future.
And sometimes it's interesting. I had one bad experience. I'd given blood several times, and I had one bad experience. And it's interesting to me because I'd never been anxious. And now when I think about it, I get more like diaphoretic, and not exactly diaphoretic, but or sweating and feel anxious. And I'm sure if the lady who is doing it, or whoever is obtaining your blood, woman or man, once they see that it's not coming out very well, it's almost that they just wiggle the needle once. And if it doesn't, put it in the other arm. I mean, because she played around with it so long that, it was not a good experience.
Well, let's talk about instead of, not just eligibility, but what can you do to make the process easier, right? You need to be well hydrated before donating blood. So the day before, the morning of, make sure you are taking in a lot of fluid, ideally water, which is going to help the blood donation process go easier. Make sure your iron levels. I have a friend who just makes sure she has a burger or a steak the night before she's scheduled to donate blood every time. Leafy greens and things that are just going to help your body feel good and relaxed. So you go in and you are, rested, and your body is prepared to make this gift of life.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I did see, what should I do before I donate? And so many of the things you just said were on that list, including like if you're donating in the afternoon, let's say after work, to eat breakfast and lunch. If you're donating in the morning, to eat breakfast. And again, the fluids are definitely important. And I probably didn't have breakfast because we went to church and then the church was having the blood drive. And my husband was done in 15 or 20 minutes, and it was like 40 minutes, and she was still rooting around. It was pretty grim. And I have a really good vein. I mean, I have lots of really good vein. So, it would have been better to
Let's
move
not
on.
scare people off. Let's not scare folks off, right?
Yeah,
Do
no.
the
So,
things you can do to prepare yourself and your body, and keep in mind, what's on the other end of this experience. It is life, potentially multiple lives that are going to be impacted. And when you think about the ripple effect of not just the individual who's receiving the blood, but their family members, their loved ones, their circles around them, the impact is enormous, and the ripples ripple on. You mentioned, when you donate blood, you learn what your blood type is, right? And I'm O negative. Another thing with our Red Cross app is maybe it takes a couple of weeks after your donation, you will get a notification about where your blood went. And I love that.
Oh, very cool.
So whether it was in the hospital across town or in the next state, for me, it's just so reassuring to know that someone in that community was in need. And because there was blood, in this case, my blood available on the shelf, they received a treatment that was vital to their life.
Okay. And again, just telling people too that there's so many different products they get from your donation. Packed red cells are what we think of as getting a transfusion, and that's abbreviated PRBC, packed red cells. But some people, they can actually spin off the plasma, which is the what the blood cells are sitting in. So you usually have a hemoglobin greater than 12 or greater than 12 and a half in men. But
We call
there's
that a power red or a double red donation,
That was
which
really
takes,
interesting that how
yeah,
you
it,
have
it
been able
takes
to
a little bit
decide.
longer in the donation chair. It takes a little bit longer, but double the potential impact. And then the other kind of donation is platelets. If you go to a center where you can donate platelets, I have a friend who donates that regularly. Again, that's oftentimes what is used by cancer patients for their treatments. So just think about it. Find your motivation, right? Is it a loved one? Is it a neighbor? Something. Find your motivation to make blood donation a constant in your life.
The Red Cross is so broad. I just wanted to feature or at least mention a couple things. One of the things in your signature was the Washington floods. So responding to disasters, and you don't have to be a medical person. I had a friend that when there was a disaster in Texas or somewhere else in one of the islands, she went and I said, Becky, what do you do? And she said, well, I'm not in the medical field. I do their recording, their non-medical things. So there have to be records made, and there have to be, meaning not a record that we listen to, but a record that of the number of donors. And again, basically, so there is work for both medical people and lay people to volunteer with the Red Cross. And your chapter had an amazing number of volunteers in general.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, I love working for the Red Cross. I'm so proud of the work that we do. We have had a challenging December. We had a challenging December this year in Western Washington and parts of Eastern Washington, where the atmospheric rivers caused flooding, and we had shelters opening all over the place. And those were volunteers who were opening those shelters, organizing to have meals delivered, to set up, cots and things like that. And inside each of those shelters, we have not only, volunteers who are providing basic shelter and feeding services, we also have in every location medical, like nurses who are doing disaster health assistance. We have disaster mental health assistance. So depending on, the role that you'd like to play, if you have something to give, I bet we can find something at the Red Cross that's going to meet your availability, your skill set, and again, you'll be making a difference in another way to your community.
We're running out of time, but I'd love to recognize the Home Fire Campaign installing free smoke alarms. And I had someone say that the fire department will come and check your alarms. So You are doing that program in your area?
We are
Okay.
and everywhere. We're you know we put a we have our home fire safety campaign that includes doing home fire education and installing smoke alarms where they are needed to make sure that house and anyone living in the house has as much notice as possible in the event a fire breaks out, right? You only have 2 minutes to escape safely, and a smoke alarm is going to give you the most notice to make sure you can do that.
So basically, for our listeners, blood donations to the Red Cross and to community centers help ensure new parents, premature babies, cancer patients, and accident victims all have access to safe and life-saving blood. So the blood gets tested. You mentioned some of the HIV was the big deal and hepatitis. And so you do get screened for many diseases. And the websites are so good. You mentioned the redcross.org. There are other areas that, so if you just put in blood donation to a search engine, you'll get a lot of ideas where you can donate. And if you can't donate, volunteer at a blood drive and encourage your family and friends to donate. One hour of time, give someone else their tomorrow. And you had another tagline. Do you remember?
Do I remember my tagline?
Yeah.
The blood need for blood is constant. I don't know. Give me a hint.
Okay. But save lot, but basically, saving lives is so very important. And as the more people who donate, the more units of blood we will have to save people's lives. I really appreciate Betsy Robinson sharing the work of the American Red Cross and helping me to recognize blood donors and the importance of donating blood. And thank you all for listening. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. If you missed any part of the program, catch the show at krfy.org under the podcast tabs. I hope you'll join me on the first and third Monday of February when I'll be talking to Jesse Vachon from the Sandpoint Area Seniors as we discuss February as Senior Independence Month.